beard. 2. Go on, eat the kids. 3rd fisherman. I marvel how the fishes live in the sea. 1st fisherman. Why, as men do a land, the great ones eat up the little ones. William Shakespeare, Pericles, Act 2, Scene 1. Many invertebrates do not recognize individuals of their own kind as anything more than food, and so a significant amount of cannibalism takes place within invertebrate groups like mollusks, clams and their pals, insects, and arachnids, spiders and scorpions. Thousands of aquatic invertebrates like clams and corals have tiny planktonic eggs and larvae, and these are often a major food source for the filter-feeding adults. Since the planktonic forms often belong to the same species as the adults feeding on them, by definition, this makes filter feeding a form of indiscriminate cannibalism. Although both fertilized and unfertilized eggs are eaten by thousands of species, the practice of consuming conspecific eggs appears to have led to the evolution of an interesting take on the concept of the kid's meal. As the name implies, trophic eggs produced by some species of spiders, lady beetles, and snails, function solely as food. These prepackaged meals often outnumber the fertilized eggs in a given clutch, a fact exemplified by the results of an observational study on the rock snail, Tiasa marginata. This species commonly lays a clutch of around 500 eggs, but averages only 16 egg-munching hatchlings. The black lace weaver spider, Amarobius ferox, behaves similarly. One day after their spiderlings hatch, new mothers lay a clutch of trophic eggs, which are doled out to their hungry babies. The trophic eggs last for 3 days, after which the spiderlings are ready for their next stage of development, but in this case the smaller gets eaten rule gets turned on its head. Arthropods like spiders, insects, and crabs are characterized by having their skeletons on the outside of their bodies. To grow in size, they undergo a regular series of molts, during which their jointed cuticle or exoskeleton is shed and replaced by a new skeleton arising from beneath the old. After their first molt, and after the trophic eggs have been consumed, black lace weaver spiderlings are too large for their mother to care for, though they are in dire need of additional food. In an extreme act of parental care, she calls the babies to her by drumming on their web and presses her body down into the gathering crowd. The ravenous spiderlings swarm over their mother's body. Then they eat her alive, draining her bodily fluids and leaving behind a husk-like corpse. Insects undergoing pupation, the quiescent stage of metamorphosis associated with the production of a chrysalis or cocoon, are also vulnerable to attack from younger conspecifics. The ravenous larva of the elephant mosquito, Toxorhynchites, not only consumes conspecific pupae, but also embarks on a killing frenzy, slaying but not eating anything unlucky enough to cross its path. The reason for this butchery appears to be the elimination of any and all potential predators before the larva enters the helpless pupal stage itself. In some snail species, cannibalistic young transform into vegetarian adults. In one food preference test, hatchlings from an herbivorous snail fed on conspecific eggs exclusively, even when offered lettuce. 4-day-old individuals ate equal amounts of eggs and lettuce, and 16-day-old individuals preferred the veggies. When snails older than 4 weeks of age were denied the lettuce option, they starved to death, even in the presence of eggs. The reason for this gradual transition in feeding preference appears to be that these snails, like other herbivores, from termites to cows, require a gut full of symbiotic bacteria before they can digest plant material. Since newly hatched snails have no gut bacteria, they're compelled to consume material that can be digested, even if this turns out to be their own unhatched siblings. Cannibalism occurs in every class of vertebrates, from fish to mammals. For researchers, factors like relatively larger body size and longer lifespans have made these backboned cannibals easier to study than invertebrates. As a result, Previously unknown examples of this behavior are being revealed on an increasingly regular basis. Additionally, factors related to the increased size and longevity of vertebrates have facilitated the ability of scientists to determine and track kin relationships. Have you tried tagging a mosquito? Leading to greater understanding of the complexities of cannibalism-related behaviors. One such result has been the classification of distinct forms of cannibalism, such as filial cannibalism, eating one's own offspring, and heterocannibalism, eating unrelated conspecifics, both of which have become vital to the concept of cannibalism as normal behavior. In mammals, filial cannibalism has been reported in rodents like voles, mice, and wood rats, and lagomorphs, rabbits and their relatives, as well as shrews, moles, and hedgehogs, also known as the mammals formerly known as insectivores. These mammal moms sometimes eat their young to reduce litter size during periods when food is scarce. Cannibalism also occurs when litter size exceeds the number of available teats or when pups are deformed, weak, or dead. In the fishes, by far the largest of the traditional vertebrate classes, individuals in every aquatic environment and at every developmental stage are ambushed, chased, snapped up, and gulped down on a scale unseen in terrestrial vertebrates. One reason that cannibalism occurs so frequently in fish may be the fact that the group as a whole has more in common with the invertebrates, where cannibalism is often the rule and not the exception, than do the other vertebrate classes, reptiles, birds, and mammals. Another way to consider this is to think of the class Pisces as a mosaic, composed of a suite of more recently evolved vertebrate traits, like a vertebral column and larger brain, but still retaining some invertebrate characteristics. Here it's the production of high numbers of tiny offspring with less parental care, as well as a proclivity for consuming both eggs and young, even one's own. At its most extreme, reproductive success in many fish species depends on a romantic-sounding technique known as broadcast spawning, during which females can release millions of eggs while males simultaneously release clouds of sperm, milt. The end result is that some of the eggs get fertilized. Conceptually, given our own reproductive behavior, one might be misled into thinking that broadcast spawning is an inefficient mating technique. The bottom line, though, is that it works, as do similar variations on this theme employed by many amphibians and invertebrate species alike. Such reproductive strategies are successful because the vast number of eggs released offsets the low probability that any single egg will develop into a mature individual. Along those lines, scientists estimate that for every million eggs produced by an Atlantic cod, Goddess Morhua, approximately one egg will result in an adult fish. Partially compensating for these lottery-like odds is the fact that each female produces between 4 and 10 million eggs in a single spawning. On a related note, while this is a remarkable number of potential offspring for most vertebrates, it's something akin to sexual dysfunction in the ocean sunfish, Mola Mola, a strange-looking open-ocean species that can broadcast 300 million eggs in a single spawning, a vertebrate record. But it's not just the abundance of eggs and young that makes fish such a popular menu item for members of their own species. Many terrestrial vertebrates produce few or even a single offspring, and most of these newly born or newly hatched individuals already exhibit considerable body size. In many fish species, the extraordinary number of eggs produced imposes a limit on their size, and so a full-grown cod might be a million times, or 6 orders of magnitude, larger than its own eggs. This fact goes a long way to explain why the majority of them exhibit about as much individual recognition of their offspring as humans do for a handful of raisins. Fish eggs, larvae, and fry, that is, young fish, are vast in number, minute in size, and high in nutritional value. This makes them an abundant, non-threatening, and easily collected food source. It's also why ichthyologists consider the absence of cannibalism in fishes, rather than its presence, to be the exceptional case. Although not quite as infrequently practiced as it is among the invertebrates, parental care occurs in only around 20% of the 420 families of bony fishes, a group composed of nearly all living species except sharks and their flattened relatives, the skates and rays. The primary reason for this trend can be explained by the fact that the natural world is full of trade-offs. Here, the trade-off works like this. Since females expend a tremendous amount of energy producing eggs, sometimes millions of them, they can't afford to expend much energy caring for them or their young when they hatch. For this reason, the eggs and fry of most fish species exist in dangerous environments inhabited by a long list of potential predators, including conspecifics. But even in the 90 or so piscine families where parental care does occur, filial cannibalism is an extremely common practice. And here the primary reason has to do with who is doing the babysitting. Among the land-dwelling vertebrates, females are the principal caregivers, while males take on support roles or simply make themselves scarce. In bony fishes that guard their own eggs, though, it's usually the males who are involved, undertaking these chores at nests otherwise known as oviposition sites. These can range from slight depressions in the substrate to rocks, plants, and other materials to which the sticky eggs, generally numbering in the hundreds, adhere in discrete clumps. The male guardians often wind up consuming some of the eggs, partial filial cannibalism, and sometimes all of them, total filial cannibalism. One reason that male fish engage in this seemingly counterproductive behavior is that, generally, they have much less invested in the brood than do females. It is less costly to produce a cloud of sperm than it is to produce, carry around, and distribute an abdomen full of eggs. Furthermore, with their ability to search for food seriously constrained by caregiving duties, males are forced to undertake at least some degree of fasting. This practice decreases their overall physical condition and thus the likelihood of future reproductive success. By consuming a portion of their own brood, males can increase the chances that they'll survive and produce additional offspring. New eggs are consumed more often than older eggs because there has been less parental investment in maintaining them. In some examples, though, the loss of eggs from an oviposition site is not the fault of a hungry male guardian. Unrelated conspecific males regularly raid nests in order to consume or steal eggs. Egg theft can be explained by the preference for some females to spawn at sites already containing eggs, even if they're not hers. In these instances, once a female deposits her own clutch, the male will selectively eat the eggs he previously stole and deposited there. While we're on the topic of parental care in fishes, mouth-brooding cichlids deserve a brief mention, if only because they serve to strengthen the often tenuous link between a mouthful of kids and lunch. Mouth-brooding occurs in at least 9 piscine families, most famously in the freshwater cichlidae. Cichlids, especially the African varieties, are extremely popular with aquarium keepers, as well as connoisseurs of tilapia, the spam of gourmet fish. With more than 1,300 species, cichlids have evolved extremely specialized lifestyles that serve to reduce competition with related species living in the same area. Mouth brooding is a common form of behavior in cichlids. Typically, it refers to post-spawning behavior in which parents, usually females, hold their brood of fertilized eggs inside their mouths until they hatch, and sometimes even after that. This provides the eggs and fry with a haven from predators, a point commonly portrayed in crowd-pleasing nature videos that depict young fish darting back into their parents' mouth at the first sign of danger. Conspicuously missing from these light-hearted reports is the fact that parents holding a mouthful of eggs usually eat a considerable portion of them, and sometimes the entire brood. Also destined for the digital equivalent of the cutting room floor are shots showing male cichlids fertilizing the eggs in the females' mouths. Always a difficult topic to explain during family TV time. Mouth brooders practice filial cannibalism primarily because, as we all know, eating a regular meal is next to impossible while carrying around a mouthful of eggs. Cichlids and other mouth brooders get around this vexing problem in the simplest way possible. Cannibalism. Interestingly, scientists had thought that for the first few days after spawning, female mouth brooders selectively consumed only unfertilized eggs from their broods. When researchers set out to determine just how mothers were able to distinguish between fertilized and unfertilized eggs, they were surprised to find that 15% of the consumed eggs were actually fertile. We now know that, mistakes aside, once all of the unfertilized eggs have been eaten, hungry mothers continue to consume small quantities of their own fertilized eggs. And should the brood reach about 20% of its original number, many mouth brooders will write off the entire batch and eat them all. As with similar examples of total filial cannibalism, this usually occurs when the cost of caring for the brood becomes higher than the benefit of producing a less-than-normal number of offspring. Rather than investing in a smaller brood, it becomes more advantageous for the female to recover some energy by consuming her remaining young and then moving on to find a new mate. My personal favorite example of piscine cannibalism is yet another instance in which immature animals are the ones getting consumed. But in sand tiger sharks, Carcharias taurus, the individuals doing the cannibalizing haven't even been born yet. Sand tigers, like hammerheads, Sphyrna zygaena, and blue sharks, Prionaes glauca, do not deposit their eggs into the environment. Instead, the eggs and young develop inside the female's oviducts, a developmental strategy known as histotrophic viviparity. Scientists who first looked at late-term sand tiger embryos in 1948 noticed that these specimens were anatomically well-developed, with a mouthful of sharp teeth. A point, or several, driven home when one researcher was bitten on the hand while probing the oviduct of a pregnant specimen. Strangely, these late-term embryos also had swollen bellies, which were initially thought to be yolk sacs, a form of stored food. This was puzzling, though, since most of the nutrient-rich yolk should have been used up by this late stage of development. Further investigations showed that the abdominal bumps weren't yolk sacs at all. They were stomachs full of smaller sharks. These embryos, averaging 19 in number, had fallen victim to the ultimate in sibling rivalry, a form of in utero cannibalism known as adelphophagy, from the ancient Greek for brother-eating or sibling cannibalism. This behavior is possible because sand tiger shark oviducts contain embryos at different developmental stages, a characteristic that also evolved in birds. Once the largest of the shark embryos run through their own yolky food supply, they begin consuming eggs. And when the eggs are gone, the ravenous fetal sharks begin consuming their smaller siblings. Ultimately, only two pups remain, one in each oviduct. According to the renowned ichthyologist Stuart Springer, the selective advantage for the young sharks may extend beyond the obvious nutritional reward. Springer, the first to study the behavior, believed that the surviving pups were born experienced young, having already killed for survival even before their birth. He hypothesized that this form of sibling cannibalism might afford the young sand tigers a competitive advantage during interactions with other predatory species also looking for a meal. Although the sand tiger is the only species known to consume embryos in utero, several other sharks exhibit a form of oophagy, in which the unborn residents of the oviduct feed on a steady supply of unfertilized eggs. Additionally, a form of adelphophagy occurs in some bony fishes, superclass Osteichthyes, in which broods mature at different rates. Once again, in these species, it's the older members of the brood that cannibalize their smaller siblings. Cannibalism of the young also occurs in many species of snakes, lizards, and crocodilians, where, for example, it accounts for significant juvenile mortality in the American alligator, Alligator mississippiensis. Although reptiles do not transition through larval stages like most fish and amphibians, the smallest and most defenseless individuals, namely eggs, neonates, and juveniles, run the greatest risk of being eaten by conspecifics. Cannibalism is relatively rare among birds, a fact that may be related to one aspect of their specialized anatomy, their beaks. These keratinous structures are responsible for the designation of most bird species as gape-limited predators. In other words, their lack of teeth limits them to consuming prey small enough to be swallowed whole. Existing under this anatomical constraint, when cannibalism does occur in birds, it's generally the eggs and young that are consumed. According to Cornell ornithologist Walter Koenig, since brood reduction is widespread in birds, it's likely that sibling cannibalism would be a lot more widespread than it is if birds had beaks that were capable of tearing dying offspring to pieces or opening their gape wide enough to swallow them whole. Heterocannibalism, in which non-kin get eaten, has been reported in 7 of the 142 bird families and is most common in colonial seabirds like gulls. Here, the practice of consuming eggs or young is an integral part of foraging strategy, and it can have a significant effect on bird populations. In one study of a colony of 900 herring gulls, Larus argentatus, approximately one quarter of the eggs and chicks were cannibalized. Heterocannibalism also occurs in acorn woodpeckers, Melanerpes formicivorus. In this species, two female woodpeckers share a single nest and will even feed and care for each other's young. But before that occurs, the nestmates may also destroy and consume each other's eggs if one bird should lay an egg first. Presumably, this is because the oldest hatchling would be the most likely to survive. To eliminate this advantage, the birds will keep eating each other's eggs until they both lay their eggs on the same day, a process that can take weeks. Sibling cannibalism, in which brothers and sisters get eaten by other brothers and sisters, is best known among the raptors, a non-taxonomic name for predatory birds like eagles, hawks, kestrels, and owls, all of which possess strong eyesight, powerful beaks, and sharp talons. The latter two characteristics exempt raptors from the gape limitation seen in many other birds and may help explain the increased frequency of cannibalism in these birds. In some species, sibling cannibalism is often the end result of asynchronous hatching, in which two eggs are laid with one of them hatching several days before the other. One can almost hear the acorn woodpeckers gasping in horror. As a result, the firstborn chick uses its extra bulk to win squabbles over food with its younger brother or sister. In instances where the parents are unable to provide their young with enough to eat, the firstborn will kill and consume its younger sibling. Researchers sometimes refer to these types of victims as food caches, as sibling cannibalism becomes an efficient way to produce well-nourished offspring, albeit fewer of them, during times of stress. Something similar happens in the snowy egret, Leucophoix thula, which commonly lays three eggs. The first two get a serious dose of hormones while still in the mother's body. The third egg receives only half the hormone boost, resulting in a less aggressive hatchling. If food is abundant, the larger nestlings simply throw the passive chick out of the nest. But if alternative sources of nutrition become scarce, the smaller sibling is stabbed to death and eaten. According to Koenig and fellow ornithologist Mark Standback, filial cannibalism in birds has been reported in 13 of 142 avian families, but is not well understood, perhaps because it is relatively infrequently observed. On rare occasions, birds like roadrunners, Geococcus californianus, will eat undersized chicks. Similarly, barn owls, Tito alba, are reported to consume their own chicks during extreme environmental conditions, such as when food is in short supply and the chicks are either starving or sick. It has been suggested that filial cannibalism of dying or decayed offspring can prevent infection and deterioration of the entire clutch. Presumably, there are also benefits to getting rid of dead chicks before they attract legions of carrion-eating flies and maggots. In most cases, however, it's the lack of alternative forms of nutrition that initiates the behavior. A lot of examples of cannibalism in birds are clearly associated with food limitation, Koenig told me. We're basically talking about a lifeboat strategy where the strong cannibalize the weak.